Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Talking Markets on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Today's conversation will focus on a range of top-of-mind topics of investors at the moment. This includes the road ahead for monetary policy, the U.S. economy, along with U.S. trade policy. We will also spend some time on asset allocation. So plenty to cover today. Joining me here for the conversation at our 1285 podcast studio here in New York, glad to welcome Apollo Lupescu, Vice President with Dimensional Fund Advisors. Apollo, it's great to be at the table with you. Thank you for dropping by the studio and for spending some time with our listeners and our clients. It's great to have you.
Dan, it's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation. I look forward to our conversation. A lot of interesting topics and a lot to cover.
So where to begin, right? Though, just thinking through 2025, I know U.S. trade policy, tariffs in particular, have really informed, influenced the economic and investment outlooks of many. So maybe that's a good starting point. How, Apollo, do you anticipate that U.S. trade policy will evolve from here, let's say over the near term, as a lot of the big deals at this point appear to have been ironed out, but some outstanding, and into 2026? What's ahead?
Yeah, and I think you kind of said it very well. There is a lot of uncertainty around the future policies. And what's interesting is that so far, we do believe that markets have already priced in whatever expectations are on the tariff policy. And that's already been baked into prices. And whatever you see right now has those expectations priced in. And the one thing that will move the market are not these expected factors, but rather unexpected. And as you said, there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of unexpected moves that could come down the road, but those are not foreseeable. And we don't encourage investors to act upon those unforeseeable events. We'd rather consider the prices right now are pretty fair in terms of the expectations of the impact mm-hmm. of tariffs. But there are a couple of things that I want to touch on. The first one is that when we looked at data, we don't find that tariffs are the primary driver of the stock market, only one particular stock per se, over the long run. And to give an example, if you look at the first Trump administration, there was a lot of talk about tariffs and trade wars, and we had a lot of these conversations 8 years ago. Sure. And if you look at the 4 years of the first Trump administration, the U.S. stock market, as reflected by the S&P 500, mm-hmm. over the course of those 4 years, it went up by about 80%. 80% over 4 years, despite all the trade wars and the tariffs that we had to deal with. But what's even more interesting then is that if you look at the markets that we targeted, for example, we targeted the Chinese economy, mm-hmm. and you look at the Chinese stock market over the same exact 4 years, it did not go up by 80%. The MSCI China over the exact same 4 years went up by 100%. It outperformed the U.S. market. And if tariffs were indeed the primary driver, it's unlikely that we would have seen this. And interesting enough, this year, through the end of June, the U.S. stock market's up roughly about 6%. But you look at the Chinese market, is up pretty much three times as much as the U.S. market, almost 18%. You look at our tariffs to North, Canada, supposedly so impacted by us, they're up twice as much as we are in terms of nominal returns. You look at Mexico, the Mexican stock market is up about 30%. While the U.S. is up about 6%, and even a European economy like Germany, so dependent on exports, the stock market is up about 34-35%, significantly more than the U.S. And this is just a cautionary tale. There's a lot of noise out there, and if you get carried away saying tariffs is good or bad, you might not realize that there are so many other variables driving the market. And this is one of the many, 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 many factors. It's just not a primary one. And, you know, the last comment on this is that companies, pretty much going back to the first Trump administration and then now, they are used to navigating whatever is put in front of them. And companies are not going to stand still. They're going to try to find out, how do I make the most of what's being in front of me, put in front of me? And I think that's really important to know, that these companies tend to be resilient. They're very innovative. And a lot of times when they confront a challenge, they might end up on the other end stronger. And that's something to be just reminded that this is not the first time, and it's quite possible that firms might come out of this stronger, and probably that might be one of the reasons why the market is going up.
And then outside of trade policy, thinking back a couple of months ago at this point, the One Big Beautiful Bill, which was signed into law on July 4th around that time frame, you think about its potential economic impact as we head into 2026 with the tax implications. What are your thoughts there? there.
Yeah, so I think that there certainly will be, you know, some economic implications. But when it comes to market, then what I think it's so interesting is that the investors have had plenty of time to absorb the implication of the bill and price it in. So I don't believe that the mega bill in any way will drive the market, because that's already been priced and people already know exactly what is the economic implication of this for each company and what it will change the expected profits for that particular company. So I don't believe that in any way going forward, the mega bill has any bearing of the market. But I do think that it is it will have different impact on different companies. And I do think that the extent of the bill was more to preserve certain tax cuts. Mm-hmm. And most people are not necessarily going to see a vastly different tax bill than they had over the past few years. So in that respect, I really don't expect a huge change in the behavior of consumers or businesses, because they're just going to continue the same way that they've been. So I don't see that as having a major impact on the economy, because you're not adding any more to somebody's ultimate leftover money after taxes. It's just going to be the same that they've had over the past few years. So, you know, the behavior is likely to be quite the same. And whatever other changes have been tax-wise on the margin, most people will not be impacted by them.
What about your thoughts on the overall health of the U.S. economy at the moment? It's interesting, about a year ago from today, there were concerns over the prospects for an impending recession, which really never came to pass. Though you look at where we are today, concerns over the impacts of U.S. trade policy, tariffs to facets of the economy, such as inflation more recently. But how would you characterize its health? And are there any red flags that would point to any recession indicators?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, because we've heard going back a few years the possibility of recession.
Right.
And nobody kind of says yes or no. It basically says the probability, the odds. And we've heard for years and years that the odds went from 20% to 60%, back to 20%. So I want to be straightforward, Dan. I don't want to toss in my opinion, because it's not any better or worse than anybody else's. It's just pure guesswork at this point. There are a lot of events that have not happened yet, and they are foreseen, that might drive the future of the economy. And because of that, it's hard to pinpoint like what's going to happen to the economy. But in my opinion, this is my personal view, is that the U.S. economy is pretty much like a huge freight train. And it's been chugging along at a pretty constant speed. And sometimes it slows down a bit, and sometimes it goes a little faster. Mm-hmm. But by and large, this freight train has so much inertia, and it's going so steadily that even if there's a little variation up or down, it's not going to be super meaningful. Mm-hmm. In fact, interestingly enough, since 1978, the U.S. has delegated the responsibility of declaring a recession, not to the media or people like us, but rather a group of 8 economists who are part of a group of the National Bureau of Economic Research. And they're the only ones in society who can determine if the U.S. is in a recession or not. And since 1978, the U.S. has had 6 official recessions. The most severe ones in the early 80s and during the financial crisis. And the shortest one happened to be during the pandemic. It was 2 months. But think about it, when you hear that, oh, there were 2 consecutive quarters of negative economic growth, that's not the case for the pandemic. We only had 2 months of a recession, which theoretically could not have been a recession. So what I'm pointing out to here is this economic slowdown. It is something that is determined by a group of economists, not the media, and sometimes they declare this after the fact. So it's hard for anybody to try to really predict a recession when the only people in society declare it after the fact quite often. And it's based not only on just strict guidelines, but a lot of times their judgment. And they kind of made it very clear. Our judgment, the economy slowed down enough in the pandemic, what it's worth declaring a recession. But again, there are no strict guidelines for recession. It's more in the eye of these 8 beholders of this. It's called the Economic Cycle Dating Committee, and not dating
the
each other.
Yeah, of course. As we're speaking, soon to be, if not already, the Jackson Hole Symposium underway. We will hear from the chairman, Jerome Powell, on Friday, perhaps his farewell address as chairman. What are your thoughts on monetary policy as we're heading into the September meeting? A lot of anticipation over a potential 25 basis point cut. But even beyond that, where do you see the road ahead for monetary policy going from here?
Yeah, and it's quite interesting, because the Fed economically has this dual mandate. One is to keep prices stable, yep, and the other one is to have high employment. And quite often, these two could be in conflict. And what's been interesting is that while we had the spike of inflation because of the pandemic in 2022, the Fed acted by raising rates at the risk of perhaps slowing down the economy, which fortunately did not happen. But the economic theory clearly states that if inflation is high, one of the ways that you want to bring it back down is by raising rates. So I do believe that whatever the Fed is going to do is based on data. Mm-hmm. And if inflation stays in check, then there's a lot more reason to believe that they will lower the rates because they don't want to hurt the economy. They're not really in the business of damaging anything. And the comment that I want to make, though, is that I think a lot of people give the Fed a little too much credit. The Fed directly controls some very short-term rates. Typically, that's called the federal funds rate, which might impact very short-term lending. So if you're a large corporation that has thousands of employees and you don't want to hold enough cash in your checking account to make payroll, well, you can take these overnight loans. Mm-hmm. And if when the Fed lowers this rate, that's a benefit to you. If you are, on the other hand, a saver who put money in CDs, well, CDs have to buy these short-term instruments. And when the rates go down, you're going to see the rates on CDs lower. So when the Fed acts upon this interest rate move, the impact tends to be on very short-term rates. But Dan, what's so interesting is that it is not a driver of long-term rates. For example, if you look at mortgage rates, sort of the foundational base for the mortgage rates is the 10-year U.S. Treasury, not the federal funds rate. And then there is a spread on top of that because of banks and so forth. But here's what's interesting. In 2023, when the rates were high, the Fed held everything steady on the federal funds rate till about September of 2024. And over the time period when the Fed had no actions, the 10-year treasury dropped by over 1%, even the Fed making no moves. And then in September last year, the Fed cut rates three times by about 1%. But here's what's interesting. The 10-year treasury went up and quite significantly. So it doesn't have to move. It has a mind of its own. And it's driven by a lot of factors. And one of them, one of the many is the expected inflation looking ahead. So what's going to drive mortgage rates and what's going to drive some of these longer term borrowing rates are not actions by the Fed, but rather what investors expect inflation to be over the next few years. And that's a much more important driver of the long-term rates than the Fed.
So speaking about something that perhaps has a mind of its own, artificial intelligence has been a top of mind for many. It remains one of their more notable investment themes here at the UBS Chief Investment Office. We have even seen the developments of cheaper models come out of China this year, which spurred a bit of volatility in the market. What is your view when it comes to AI investing, how best to put money to work?
Yeah, and it's interesting because it is an amazing technology. I mean, I don't know, I use it once in a while.
Of course.
I wrote poems for my wife that were so good that she knew that's not me.
The word's out.
Yeah, she knows, probably. So it will change. I mean, you look at the internet, and people realize that I don't know exactly at the moment how this will change the world, but we know it will. And I think we're in a moment right now that it is a technology similar to when the internet came out. And it took some time for the economy and consumers and businesses to adapt to the new technology. And it took a while to figure out exactly what's the benefit and what are the limitations of that technology. But I think you said it right. From an investor perspective, I think there are four elements that I really want to emphasize. The number one is that if you are hyper-focused on the creators of AI, well, it turns out that a bigger beneficiary might be the users of AI. If you think of the scanning technology of the supermarket, well, who's the bigger beneficiary, the supermarket itself or the scanning company that creates that machine? And in that respect, if you are a creator, right now what's fascinating is the amount of money that's being plowed into this industry to create these models. And ultimately, at the moment, it's not like cleanly monetized. It's not like, oh, they're making so much money. No, they're plowing a lot of money with the expectation that at some point they might make money, but that hasn't really been figured out. The same way the internet. The internet, nobody, like Google, didn't figure out how to make money until years down the road. And other companies were in the same boat. So it's you got to be a little careful there on the user versus the creator and the monetization of the creators. The second one that I think it's important is the valuations associated with some of these AI creators, these technology companies that create AI. Because right now, some of the valuations are baking in some incredible highs, rates of growth at some point. Mm-hmm. And it might be worth holding those companies because they might realize. But pay attention because some of these valuations could be very, very high. Right. The third point that I want to make is that AI is not strictly a U.S. enterprise. If you think of NVIDIA, it's a great example. NVIDIA designs chips. And think of NVIDIA as a baker. That has created the recipe for the best cookie in the world. Sure. That's what they do. But they create the recipe. It's just they don't have a kitchen. NVIDIA doesn't have any manufacturing facilities. And in fact, there is only one single company in the world that can produce their most advanced chips. And that company happens to be an emerging markets investment, and it's Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation. And without TSMC, NVIDIA had nothing to sell. Mm-hmm. And for TSMC to create those, for that kinship to operate, they need an incredibly specialized oven. And that's a machine that is made by a company that trades in the Netherlands called ASML. And without that machine created by ASML, there would be no way for TSMC to produce the
a lot of layers.
And it kind of, in this global value chain, at some point you have to stop and wonder who holds the cards. Right. And it's all of them. And I think that that's kind of hard to say, well, that holds the cards. But the reality is that, you know, NVIDIA has to fight for capacity at TSMC factories, pretty much with Google and Apple and all the other ones. So, you know, who holds the cards? I think everyone. So that's why it's a global enterprise. And the last point that I would make down on AI, absolutely you want to own AI. There's no doubt in my mind. Go ahead and own AI stocks. But own AI commensurate to its expected economic profits that it will generate. And that's what the stock market allows you to get. And to give you a perspective, Magnificent Seven. In the NASDAQ composite index, Magnificent Seven, as at the end of last year or mid this year, actually, these Magnificent Seven amounted to about 53% of the entire NASDAQ index. Which means that if you bought QQQ on NASDAQ, not any one product, but if you bought the index, about 53% of your money would be invested in these seven companies, which is one way to do it. The other one is to look at the S&P. The same exact Magnificent Seven are in the S&P at about 33%. But from a global perspective, if you look at the MSCI index, the same exact seven companies are there at about 18%. Hmm. So from a global perspective, we do believe that you want to own them commensurate with their...
a lot of concentration.
Exactly. You want to be careful not to overdo it.
Right.
And I think that if you go into the NASDAQ or the S&P, you're not as diversified as you could be with a global allocation, which would include TSMC, which would include ASML, and so forth.
In the spirit of diversification, if we're broadening out from AI, looking at the asset allocation table, where are you finding the most opportunities at the moment?
Yeah, so I think at the moment, like because of all the things that we talked about, we do think that the starting point to capture these opportunities is the market as a whole. In fact, the global opportunity set. There are about 12,000 different companies, and there are investments right now, funds, that would provide you comprehensive exposure to pretty much a lot of these companies. But we do see opportunities beyond the market in three different characteristics of stocks. We do believe that data has kind of clearly shown that smaller companies, they tend to outperform over the long run the larger ones. And intuitively, they have more room to grow. And it's mm-hmm. probably easier to double from, you know, 20 billion to 40 billion than 200 billion to 400 billion. So that's one area that you can look at, the small companies as a whole. The second one is the valuations. And this is reflected in the price of a company relative to some accounting fundamental. And it could be earnings, book value. We think it's a pretty solid one. And in that respect, the companies that have a lower price relative to the ones that have a higher price, we do see those as an opportunity to have a higher expected return over the long run. And the third characteristics of stocks is around how profitable they are. The high profitability companies, data has shown that they tend to do better than the low profitability stocks. So what we see as an opportunity is capture the global marketplace, and perhaps emphasize a little bit more the smaller companies, the value and high profitability without necessarily excluding everything else. It's just tilting the tray a little bit. You know, just take a little bit from large growth and low profitability and distribute those assets, that money into an allocation more mm-hmm. towards small value and high profitability.
Well, Apollo, terrific guidance and insights today. You've covered a lot of ground for our listeners, our clients. Before we close out, any final thoughts, takeaways, anything you would want to reinforce for our audience?
I think the big one that I want to reinforce is something that I see quite often is that there's so much noise, and this noise tends to generate different types of risks for investors. And it's an emotional risk. It's a human behavior risk. And it's either the fear of loss mm-hmm. and people are concerned and I want to do something with my money because I'm afraid that something bad is going to happen and they might want to jump out of the market. But there's the other side, which is the fear of missing out, the FOMO, that I don't want to miss out. Look how much money is being made left and right. And I think both of these emotions are legitimate as a human being, as an investor. At the same time, you want to be cautious not to let these emotions drive your investment decisions and be much more pragmatic, acknowledge the emotions, and at the same time, disentangle them and work with a financial professional. Sure. Work with a UBS advisor because they are really good at analyzing and figure out, is this the smart thing to do with your money? Right. And to me, like the biggest takeaway is that work with a financial advisor. Not only because it helps coach some of these behavioral aspects of investing, but also because they can help you create that allocation that I talked about, global in nature, emphasizing small value profitability. And that's something that your advisor can help you with.
And it doesn't hurt to turn off the TV from time to time, as you alluded to, just to
tune out the noise.
Keep the noise out of it. Well, Apollo, absolute pleasure. Thank you for dropping by the New York studio. It was great catching up with you in person. And I do look forward to doing this again at some point.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Financial Services, Inc. does not provide legal or tax advice, and this does not constitute such advice. UBS strongly recommends that persons obtain appropriate independent legal, tax, and other professional advice. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC.